Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines with insights and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up a little later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up on our program, a legal battle looming over South Africa's new cannabis product clampdown. How flexible benefits are now attracting skilled workers. 2 years of PayShap, are the real-time payments really transforming the economy? And the contribution of secondary steel producers as the ArcelorMittal closure battle intensifies. It's Monday, the 24th of March. South Africa's cannabis industry says it's being pushed to the brink. A new directive from the Minister of Health has banned the manufacture and sale of non-medicinal cannabis products. And that has understandably triggered outrage from businesses who claim they've invested millions and have followed all the rules. The Cannabis Trade Association Africa says it's now heading to court. And in that respect, I'm joined by its chairperson, Tebogo Tlopane. Tebogo, let's start with the basics and a very warm welcome to you. What exactly has been banned by the minister's directive?
Well, basically, the minister has banned, literally blanket ban, on any edibles that have hemp and hemp derivative, meaning that you're looking at your CBD, which is, you know, at your medicinal level. You're then looking at, from an edible point of view, looking at your proteins, protein that are coming out of hemp seeds. As you know, it's the most nutritious grain there is in terms of the protein. I mean, the protein's got 9 amino acids. So when you're looking at about nutrition, that part is gone completely if the ban stays. And that affects the R&D work that's been done with CSIR, with many, many different companies that have actually produced amazing nutrition bars that can be, you know, provided for kids at school and so forth and so on. So these are the things that are actually being banned across the board, including anything that has to do with any derivative out of cannabis. So you see product being pulled out of stores, you know, major retailers and stuff like that. So it's a huge disruption into the industry. And it's an ongoing goal we don't need right now, because we're trying to obviously formalize the industry and make sure that we extract as much as possible out of it.
Was this decision surprising to you? Was it dropped on the industry without warning?
100%. One thing that we noticed about this decision is that the signature of the minister was actually done in January. So there was no communication between January up until when it was actually published on the 7th of March. The whole industry is unaware of changes. Even, you know, we are assisting the government with the COVID master plan. The intergovernmental committees that have been set up to actually make sure that this cannabis master plan become a reality also was not even aware. So we don't know where this is coming from. And we've asked questions to find out where did it come from, what made it an emergency, because also you got to follow the process and the due process. When you gazette something like this, there has to be public participation. The minister obviously has the prerogative to actually sign something like this into law, but there has to be an emergency. So they did state that it is an emergency. So we asked them, where is the emergency? What actually had happened, so that we can have something that is so destructive as an emergency in a law, basically.
At this point, is there any engagement with government behind the scenes, or is this going to end up in court?
There's engagement, Jeremy, behind the scene. We don't want to, you know, divulge what those engagements are, but there are engagements that are taking place. There's a lot of pressure that's been applied to the ministry itself, to the presidency as well, by various ministerial committees that are part and parcel. The leading department is the Department of Trade and Industry, led by Minister Pakstau, which has actually been given this master plan. Now, the master plan, you can call it the Bible of how this industry should actually work, how this industry should actually be governed. How do we unlock the potential of this industry? I mean, we made a lot of examples in terms of what will look like when you have a fully fledged, legalized economy on cannabis. And we're looking at states like Colorado, where we've seen that they've collected up to trillion of rand in terms of revenue coming out of cannabis, because there's various level of taxes that can be applied. And none of the guys that are in cannabis, you know, are saying they don't want to pay taxes. We're saying tax it proportionately, making sure that there's money going to the fiscus, which is the whole point. Now, you've driven around, you've walked around. I'm sure you've seen, you know, all these stores that are popping up all over the place, whether you're talking Joburg or Cape Town or Durban, it's the same thing. But out of all those things, who's making the money? And I think when we have something that makes sense, then we can then be able to have government actually making money from that instead of increasing, you know, VAT as they've done now.
So let me ask you this then. What kind of investment and job losses are we talking about if this directive is enforced?
We're talking millions, Jeremy. We're talking millions. I think from the highest level in terms of looking at analysis for a typical company that actually imports, you're looking at guys that are sitting with inventory of millions and millions of rands. And you're looking at guys that are employing guys locally to pack and do all sorts of things. They'll also lose their jobs. So you're looking at staggering amount of people that will lose their jobs because of all this, if this stays in the current course where it is. We hope that it doesn't. We hope that there'll be reason. We hope that there'll be some sort of a reprieve from the minister to say, look, we will take it back so that we can allow this. Or even if there's a element of regulatory that the minister feels that they need to be doing, engaging with the industry is always the best way, because then there's no disruption. We can then be able to advise on how this can be done. But this unilateral decision is not helping anybody. Doesn't help the country, doesn't help the minister, doesn't help the unemployment we have in this country, which is quite high. And our goal is to try to bring it down as much as possible.
What do you say to critics who argue the industry that you represent has operated in a legal grey zone for too long?
As you know, Jeremy, government always plays catch up with industry all the time. It's not just South Africa, it's all over the world. So what does that mean? That means legislation is always going to play catch up to, obviously, entrepreneurs that are making possibility of creating opportunity for themselves and their families and people around them. So the legislation must be there 100%. We understand that there's a catch up that needs to be done. We also, as I said, assisting the Department of Trade to actually formalize a cannabis master plan so that we can have some sort of a guidelines. It is important that there has to be some sort of a management of control of some way in terms of making sure that these products aren't lending to children, or even the packaging must be childproof packaging. All these things are guidelines that we ourselves are providing to those that are running social club model, which, by the way, it's protected by the law, with the Constitutional Court protects that, and the Cannabis for Private People's Bill also protects that. So you cannot stop that, but we need to obviously control and manage and make sure that there are ways in making sure that guys aren't selling these things to kids.
Just finally and briefly, do you see this then as a political issue, a regulatory issue, or just a misunderstanding by government of the potential of the cannabis economy?
There's no doubt about the potential of the cannabis economy. And the reason I say there's no doubt is because we have other countries that have started this 10 years ago. You've got Canada, you've got a few states in the US that are doing it. So there is data that we can draw from and see where the opportunities are going to be coming from and what we need to be doing and how do we make sure that we control the entire value chain, because the job creation is in the value chain, not necessarily the end product itself, from the cultivation, the processing, the preparations of all these products, packaging, and so forth and so on. That's where the money is at, and that's where we need to be actually putting focus on. So as far as that is concerned, we believe that this is a perfect industry for us to actually create jobs, which will also help the current fiscus with money, because there isn't any money. That's why they're going on increasing VAT. Whether or not they're increasing 0.5 this time around, the next time around 0.5, the fact of the matter that VAT is going to be increased. So what do we do then? So it's important that we look at opportunities like the cannabis economy and making sure that we nourish these things. There are people out there, Jeremy, that prefers to smoke cannabis as opposed to drinking alcohol, and you gotta, it's their choice, and we gotta make sure that according to the constitution that they have access to that.
Okay, I'm gonna leave it there. Tebogo Tlhopane, thank you very much indeed, chairperson of the Cannabis Trade Association of Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up to date stories.
I don't need to tell you the war for talent is heating up, and South African companies are facing increasing pressure to attract and retain skilled employees. And one key strategy that is gaining traction are flexible benefits. So gone are the days when a standard salary package was enough. Today's workforce, particularly high demand professionals, want options tailored to their individual needs, from work-life balance, which is obviously important these days, to financial incentives and wellness benefits. But here's my question. How do companies design benefit structures that not only attract top talent, but also keeping them engaged is critical as well? I'm going to talk now to Lindiwe Sebeshu, Master Reward Specialist and Executive Committee Member at the South African Reward Association. Lindiwe, a very warm welcome to you. So why are flexible benefits becoming such a key factor in attracting skilled workers?
Thank you, Jeremy. We really appreciate the opportunity as the South African Reward Association. Yes, flexibility and choice has become quite a thing for talent. And this is really about making sure that we don't assume a one-size-fits-all approach to the way that we offer remuneration and benefits. So what's happening is a lot of people have started really appreciating that the packages they get from their employers include benefits, and those benefits really need to talk to their needs. So what we are finding is more and more employees, as they become aware of these benefits, are looking at which of these benefits can really align to their life stage, can really talk to the needs that they have. Are they young people, or are they people close to retirement and therefore would need to structure benefits that talk to wherever they are in their life stage, so that they really get the most value out of those benefits?
When it comes to the demand for flexible benefits, are we talking about all skills, all talent, or are there specific sectors, I wonder, to which this is more applicable to? And I guess add to that question, which age group or age demographic is more demanding about that flexibility?
Generally, the younger employees, because they're also more employed. But let's not underestimate the wisdom of the older employees as well. I think the older employees, as they get towards retirement, for instance, looking at their retirement benefits, are most likely to start thinking about whether they have saved enough for retirement, and therefore look at whether companies are providing them flexibility, for instance, to increase their retirement saving contributions as they get closer to retirement. The younger workers obviously think about the short-term needs. For instance, they would like, to save, yes, for towards retirement, but maybe at a contribution rate that's aligned to their need for short-term or higher short-term, net pay flexibility. So it's across the spectrum, Jeremy. We've got five generations working in the workforce right now. And it is prudent for employers to understand the needs of those generations and structure their benefits accordingly.
All right. So that's the theory or the philosophy behind it. Are you able to tell me what the most popular flexible benefits are that employees are looking for?
Jeremy, it varies. So yes, we've come particularly from a very big focus on flexible work arrangements. But we are now seeing, as we've just said, on the core benefit side, if you look at retirement benefits, a one-size-fits-all contribution approach towards retirement is no longer working. So employees are looking at how can they have different contribution options, health and wellness benefits. So medical aid is not the only approach that employers can provide for their employees. So there are different structures of health insurance, for instance, that could be provided as an alternative to the traditional medical aid. There are other benefits like leave type benefits. For instance, there are employees that are now always looking at what leave provisions organizations have. So yes, there are basic conditions of employment act related leave provisions, but employees are also looking for things like sabbatical leaves type. They're looking at the amount of leave that's provided, for instance, from a paternity leave perspective. And this is not just maternity leave in terms of looking at just females. More and more younger employees are wanting to be involved in the raising of their children, and therefore they look at the provisions around paternity leave so that they can also as fathers contribute to the bringing up of their young families if they are at that stage where they are still building families. So it's a variety of benefits that the employer needs to be considerate of, and that's why we say it's very important to understand the profile of your people, their life stage, as well as their age, as you already mentioned.
I'm going to assume that companies are finding it difficult, though, to balance these customizable benefits that you talk about, but also keeping cost under control.
Absolutely. And that's why, as we said in our release, it's important to look at various factors. Make sure that your benefits don't then, or flexibility doesn't then, mean administrative costs go up. In an ideal world, you would have a platform wherein your people can, within boundaries, obviously, manage their benefit flexibility to the extent that it doesn't then add cost to the administration thereof for you as an employer.
Is there empirical data which illustrates how benefits really contribute not only to retention, but also engagement? What have you noticed in that respect?
So a lot of companies do what we call engagement surveys, which is employee engagement surveys. And those are actually the feedback mechanisms that they can use to understand what would be valuable for their employees in terms of the benefit structures that they offer. And in most cases, we see that the level of engagement increases where employees are getting the benefits that they see as most valuable depending on their life stage. So there are quite a lot of engagement surveys. These differ, I must say, Jeremy, depending on the nature of the organization. But generally, we see that engagement increases where the employee's total remuneration package allows for flexibility in a manner that also supports their overall well-being, because if that's taken care of, then their productivity in as far as the work that they do also improves.
Let me also suggest to you that given that we're not seeing parity in benefits anymore because flexibility is becoming important, it's critical for an organization to manage, I would imagine, either envy or resentment within the workforce, because some people could be seen to be getting a better deal than others, if you understand what I'm saying.
I definitely understand, Jeremy, and that's why at the end of the day, you still as an employer have to manage the overall cost of the total reward offering that you give to your employees. So this is all within a very well-defined total cost to company structure that you then must manage. Because ultimately, if employees are paid fairly and equitably relative to their total cost, what's within that then can be managed in line with the employees' needs. But obviously the cost thereof is not different or shouldn't be different for work of equal value.
And that is a glimpse at the future world of work. Thank you very much indeed. I've been talking to Lindiwe Sebesho, Master Reward Specialist, Executive Committee Member at the South African Reward Association. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, real-time payments were once seen as a futuristic concept, but PaySharp has made them a reality in South Africa. That's been well documented. 2 years since its launch, transaction volumes, we read, have skyrocketed. Financial inclusion is growing. All of that is good news. But here's my question. Is this a real game changer, or is it still falling short of its full potential? I'm going to put some questions now to Israel Skosana, Chief Product and Scheme Officer at BankServe Africa. So as I've just mentioned, and welcome to you. This concept has seen significant growth, but is it fair to say that adoption remains uneven across different income groups? So is it a success story or just a promising start?
Jeremy, it's an exciting time. That's one part that I can share with you. It is exciting that South Africans have developed PaySharp, and it was launched 2 years ago. Its success has definitely been demonstrated based on the volumes that we've seen so far, but there's definitely room for improvement. And this is going to come through by participation of greater banks to come on board, as we currently have 10 banks and we're expecting another 4 banks to come on during the course of 2025. So that access to PaySharp will increase. Also, banks are being innovative in terms of their customer experience of PaySharp to make sure that it's as seamless as possible and as simple as possible, such as just using your cell phone number. Next is, let's see how innovation plays a role there to make it even more seamless, supporting greater adoption, such as the introduction of QR payments, where you would be able to just scan and do payments. Mm. So it's an exciting time and definitely a feather in the cap of South African payments.
Are you able to tell me within which demographics the concept is finding traction and where more work needs to be done?
We are definitely looking at the moment, seeing significant volumes come through in terms of the mass market space, so where cash needs to be displaced. And the use cases and the focus from Banks of Africa for PayShop has been to make sure that we want to displace cash. So examples would be car washes within the township economy, is looking for those type of environments where cash can be displaced. And obviously seeing opportunities there where it can then grow to different demographics and also in different use cases, such as the formal retail networks, where we could partner with them to ensure that PayShop is an option for payment going forward.
But it's a difficult case to make to the informal economy, isn't it?
Well, it's a simplification that is taking place. It's the providing security. It's providing certainty of payment. And if anything, trying to reduce the cost of payments taking place within all economies in South Africa. If anything, it is a journey, but it's an exciting one that says it goes on the digital journey, which the rest of the world is going on, but in order to provide that security, certainty of payments taking place.
Israel, I acknowledge that the promise of real-time payment is convenience, but again, one's got to ask the question about how truly cost-effective it is for everyday users if, say, you compare it to traditional EFTs?
Oh, well, in comparison to EFT, EFT doesn't even feature within a cash-heavy economy. So let's talk about those examples in terms of the townships. So it's not even playing in that space. If anything, real-time payments in the case of PayShop is really trying to make sure it is as close to zero for transactions to take place for customers. And there's different use cases. When you're referring to EFTs, we're obviously talking about a more formal banked environment, which results in paying school fees and the likes. And those require a different use case, different product proposition versus PayShop. And we'll recall that PayShop initially had its limit of up to 3,000 Rand to do a PayShop transaction. So clearly identifying where it was supposed to play and support the South African economy, and then up that up to 50,000 Rand recently to see how that could also assist in a broader payments use case going forward.
You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I would suggest to you that digital fraud would be a growing concern when it comes to real-time payment. Are security risks starting to emerge, and is the system itself keeping up?
Firstly, the system is keeping up. We are enjoying a 99% success rate in terms of transaction clearing, which is the testament to the experience from Banks of Africa. As Africa's largest clearinghouse across 19 countries, you had the opportunity to process transactions to the value of around about 17 trillion during the course of 2024. So, experience is coming through there. That stability that is put in place after 50 years of experience is coming through to make sure that you have that satisfaction and certainty take place. What is going to be interesting is how fraud comes into the fold. At this point in time, very low fraud levels, but at the same time, we need to make sure that we're one step ahead of the fraudsters, ensuring that we're constantly putting in the security measures in partnership with the banks and any other third parties to ensure that it is a secure environment. And that's already taking place. So fraud was built into the payment transaction based on our experience from the past.
I want to come back to the banks if I can. And again, correct me if I've misinterpreted this, but banks would still charge fees on PayShop transactions, unlike free cash transfers, I think, in other countries. Maybe this is also a barrier to broader adoption.
Yes, the cost that the consumers experience will vary from bank to bank. It's obviously at the bank's discretion in terms of how they price for it, but it is an opportunity to see how can it be reduced as much as possible and also allow for market dynamics to play through. Let's see how competitors show up with this innovation, how they deliver it to customers, and see which solution customers elect to go with.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Always good talking to you. Israel Skosana, Chief Product and Scheme Officer at Banks of Africa. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's steel industry is at a turning point. Now, while traditional blast furnace steel making has long dominated, mini mills like Kucher Steel are proving to be a game changer. Not only do they significantly reduce carbon emissions, but also playing an increasing role in the country's steel production output. I want to discuss this and also the whole ArcelorMittal issue, the importance of green steel and the future of South Africa's steel industry. I'm joined by Amit Saini, director at Kucher Steels. Amit, the process part is very interesting, but I have to ask you this question. We are witnessing the exit of ArcelorMittal from long steel production. It really is shaking up the market. What impact is this having on your organization, your strategy and your marketing positioning?
Jeremy, with regards to AMSA's exit, I think, though it was declared back in January, but they're still engaging with the government, and whether it would go through or not is, yet to be seen. Because if we follow the news, the government might most likely give a rescue package for AMSA to continue. But with regards to the impact of the closure on our operations, their kind of manufacturing is basically primary steel manufacturing, wherein they use coal and iron ore to manufacture the steel. And we are more of a scrap-based, recycling, production-based mini mills. And we compete with each other in our markets. Having said that, Mittal, AMSA, does make quite a lot of automotive and mining components with the long steels, wherein we as mini mills, we might not be equipped at the current stage to make similar goods, but it gives us an opportunity to sort of further invest in our operations and our quality enhancement procedures so that we could sort of fill up the gap which will be created by AMSA's exit if it does happen.
I mean, just in terms of scrap metal specifically, we know that this sector has long struggled with government policies, with tariffs, with infrastructure issues. What regulatory changes would you like to see that would help your organization thrive in this new environment?
The government has sort of supported the mini mills with the PPS discount, wherein any scrap metal before it is being exported out of the country, we as mini mills, we have the first right of refusal to buy it, and it is offered to us at a discount, which not only helps us in our sustainability, but also allows us access to the quality scrap metal which would have otherwise been exported. Now, with this policy over the last decade, we have seen a lot of new mini mills come up into operation, and there are more in the pipeline. To maintain sustainability for the mini mill section, we would want the policy to sort of continue its trajectory the way it has continued over the last decade. And moreover, if a scrap export ban can be put into place into the future, it would assist our operation, because why I say that is that with the additional production capacity coming up in the country, we will come to a stage in 2 to 3 years' time wherein we foresee a sort of scrap shortage for the mini mills, wherein either they'll have to diversify, or some of us would have to, close down our operations or things like that. So to maintain the sustainability of the current operations in the country, and the additional capacity coming up, a scrap export ban would most likely assist. Another thing, too, very important thing to mention in here is that South Africa has been quite liberal and democratic in the way they have brought in the PPS and the export ban, which was introduced for a year's time, but it was later scrapped in December 23. But whereas there would be around 43 countries around the world which have already put in the export ban on scrap, given that its importance in making greener steel.
Is there any indication that there will be positive moves from your perspective on that export ban?
While all the stakeholders in the steel industry have had engagements with the government, and everyone would try to sort of submit their self-serving statements and submissions to the DTIC and to the government, it would be a very difficult call for the DTIC and the government to come out with a policy which helps out in the coexistence of all the stakeholders in the long run. Obviously, we would never want to say that AMSA should exit the operations. The industry should be such that all the stakeholders, be it the scrap recyclers, be it us as minimals, be it the primary steel producer as AMSA, and the downstream manufacturing industry, we would want the policy of the government to be formulated in such a holistic way that the interests of all the stakeholders are being kept in mind when the policy is formulated.
Aside from the export ban, you've also in the past had to deal, I imagine, with Eskom's power crisis and the logistical failures at Transnet. This has had a huge impact on all manufacturing industries. How difficult has it been for you to realistically operate at full capacity in this very risky environment?
It's been very, very challenging, Jeremy. It's not only if we go back and look at AMSA's first declaration for closure in November 23, though they did delay it because of maybe the general elections in 2024. And they had listed down three reasons for their closure. One was the high cost of energy in the country and the unreliability. And the second was the logistical challenges. And the third was the competition from the minimals. So the first two points being mentioned by AMSA are being equally applicable to everyone in the industry, all of us in the steel industry. The challenges with load shedding and the ever-escalating cost of electricity in the country has made us made our operations very challenging, and it has threatened our sustainability in the long run. So that is the reason that we as a company were also looking at investing in renewable energy projects, wherein we sort of become self-independent, not fully, but maybe even if we replace the Eskom power by 20 to 30%, it not only helps us in our reducing the cost of electricity for us, but also gives us an opportunity to have an alternative to the Eskom power.
Just a final question. The concept of green steel is gaining momentum globally. Your facility operates with induction furnaces, as I mentioned, rather than coal-fired ones. Very quickly, how is this reducing carbon emissions compared to traditional methods?
Very good question, Jeremy. See, the induction furnaces or the electric arc furnaces, our carbon footprint is 4 to 5 times lesser compared to the traditional methods of steel making. So we have that itself is a big impact on the carbon footprint. And given that we as a country have our commitments to reduce the carbon footprint, promoting greener steel production through the induction and electric arc furnace is very crucial for our country and for the economy as a whole.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Amit Saini, Director at Kocha Steel. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. We're back tomorrow live at noon and then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you. And thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.